almost said good morning. Good evening. My name is Bea, and I am an alcoholic. And I feel like I'm home here. I know so many of you for a long, long time. And it feels wonderful. Generally, at weekends, when I travel a lot, I sort of drift into orphanhood. You know how we do. We feel we don't fit anywhere, and we don't know anybody, and we're sort of, I just do that really easily. And when I came here this evening, it was just wonderful to see so many people that I've been connected with now for a long time. I think it's 9 years ago that we had the Freedom and Sobriety Roundup. And it was through that roundup that I was inspired to do the ministry that I'm involved in today, which is doing retreats on the promises and other aspects of the program. So I always think fondly, very, very fondly of this group of people, and very grateful to you. I was delighted to meet Joseph's mother, because I always thought I was his mother until tonight. I thought I was taking care of him all these years, and now he is a real mother. And she's just a delightful woman, delightful to be with and to talk to. And I prayed today, early this morning, that I would meet Rex today. He's one of my favorite people. I love him very much. He comes to the retreat we have at Pilgrim Fairs. And when I was there last time, he did this most beautiful picture for me, which I have in my office. And I think of him every single day. I'm just delighted. I'm delighted for all these crazy people who come from a long distance to be here. I mean, you're absolutely nuts, because there's nothing that I'm going to say this evening that you haven't heard. And I always feel like I have to apologize for repetition. However, I also know better, because this thing works weird. You know that. It works really strange. So let me start the little story that I tell, and by the grace of God, I haven't found it necessary to go back out and change my story. So if you want to fall asleep during this time, you're very welcome to do that, and maybe my feelings won't be hurt, but I wouldn't promise that either, because very sensitive alcoholic. I tell people everywhere that I go that, and I still say the same thing, that my life was grand until I was two. And when I got to be 2 years of age, my sister was born, and she moved into the spot. And this spot for me was my, you know, just the center where I belonged and where I knew that I should have been for always. And she moved in. And it always felt to me, it doesn't mean that this is true, but it always felt to me that they were paying much more attention to her than they were to me. And it felt to me that they were adoring at her crib regularly. And it felt to me that I was just on the outskirts of humanity, of that family. And then my parents went on having these children every year, and we ended up with five of us. And every time a new baby was born into the family, I felt like I was on the edge. Now, there are a lot of newcomers this evening, or at least within their first 30 days, and you may not have been around before, and you might be wondering what this would have to do with the disease of alcoholism, or with experience, strength, and hope. Well, you know, our big book, the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, this is the text we use, and somewhere in this big book it talks about that alcohol is but a symptom. Liquor is just a symptom of our disease, and our job now in sobriety is to get down to the causes and conditions. And some of the causes and conditions are the things that set us up from a way back that we have to sort of research and examine and unearth and come to peace with as we continue in recovery. And so I welcome all you new people, and I hope you'll stay with us, because this is a very good place to be. Anyway, there were five of us, as I said, and when I was like 8 years of age, my father went to work one day, and he never did come home because he was killed in an accident. And even as I talk about it, I still feel the sort of the shock of that, and that's a long time ago. And what I recall the most about that experience is that my mother, on the day of his funeral, called me aside and she said, "Bea, I want you to help me to raise these children." And so I set about doing the enormous task that I have not accomplished yet, which is to learn how to grow up. Now, I wish I knew. I know some of you have grown up here. I know that. But it hasn't happened to me yet. I just know that if I keep coming back, that I have a chance to do that. But anyway, what she did was she taught me everything she knew. She taught me how to clean and cook and babysit. And she also was a school teacher. And she taught me how to do all kinds of school teachery little things. And at the age of 8 and 9 and 10, I could do lots of things. Now, my mom taught me what it says in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, although she didn't know this, and I didn't know this then. But there's a sentence in there, I think it's about page 61 or so, and it says this: "Is he not?" And since I'm not a he, I always change that into she. "Is she not a victim of the delusion that she can wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world if she only manages well?" Now, if you ever were to look up the word rest in the dictionary, W-R-E-S-T, the definition is to push and pull in a violent fashion. Did any of you ever do that? Did you ever struggle where you had to get it, you know, the way it was supposed to be? So I was taught that if I could rest satisfaction and happiness out of this world, I could learn how to manage well if only I could be perfect, if only I could be efficient, if only I could be on top, if only I could compete, if only I could win. And so I grew up with that sort of a mentality that you had to be on top, and nothing was ever quite acceptably good enough, you know, and I was always striving. And so in my striving, what I decided to do in order to take care of this aspect of my life, what I decided to do was to become a saint. And so somebody got up here this evening and read out of this big book and said we are not saints, which offends me dreadfully sometimes. But, what I decided to do in becoming a saint was to become a Catholic nun. Now, I still would never know, just like I never know at the weekends how you want to spend a weekend with a Catholic nun. I wouldn't know why you'd be wanting to spend a Saturday evening with a Catholic nun. I think you're nuts. I really do. Because I presume immediately that most of you have a resentment against somebody like me. You know? And I need to let you know immediately that I didn't do it to you, okay? When I first got to AA, I used to take responsibility for the entire Catholic Church and Lutheran Church and Baptist Church and Jewish synagogue and every religion, you know. I just took it all on my shoulders. On the other hand, on the more serious note, I would like to say to you, since there's so many of you here, and I say this now every time I get the opportunity, if any of you in this room this evening, in this audience, has ever been offended or hurt by a Catholic nun or a Catholic priest, I want to make public amends to you. I want to tell you that I'm really sorry that that happened to you, because very often these human things happen in an institution like a church, other churches also, any institution. And very often you hardly ever hear anybody say that they're sorry. And I want to say that in the name of the church to which I belong. I also want to tell you that in entering these nunny bunnies, which I did 46 years ago, nearly, well, it's almost 46 years ago, it's like 45 years and 7 months and 8 days or something like that. And I always tell people that that if you've been celibate for as long as I have been celibate, you'd be counting the days too. But, you're so bad, you know that? Just, I was going to say, I can't take you anywhere. I've loved this life for my whole life. I've loved this thing that I do. But, obviously I needed a little drinky poo along the line. And some of you might be just dying to know where somebody like me would get hold of alcohol, you know? Very hard. It's very hard. And so what I did was I joined the Nunny Bunnies and I started into this life, and they sent me over to England from Ireland to finish my education, and I did some of that, and then I was teaching in England, and I was doing fine. Except that In my mind, on a regular basis, a little voice would go off loudly. And the voice would say something like this: if only they would shape up, I would feel better. Now, they could be anybody. They could be the government. They could be the people I lived with. They could be the people I taught with. It was different people all the time. I had within me that little restlessness. The book is very insulting when it talks about us being restless, irritable, and discontent. You know, there were just that little restlessness. And not being in touch with that orphaned, lonely little child that I was for so long. And I didn't know what was wrong with me. And so one day I came home from school, and there was a notice from our head lady back in Ireland, and she said, would any of you like to go to California? She was offering this opportunity to any of us who wanted to volunteer to go to what she called the missions in California. And so I wasn't that interested in the missions, but I was interested in being near Hollywood. And so I signed up, and they picked me, and I got to go. And I left Ireland. I had to go back to Ireland from England to do all my paperwork. And I left Ireland on the 16th of August, 1964. And as I was leaving, my superior just said to me, as I was going out, she just said, sister, we're going to put you in charge. Now, I don't know how you feel about this, but I know for me, and I know from experience with lots and lots of alcoholics, that there's nothing that an alcoholic likes to hear better than they're going to be put in charge. We do it in a variety of ways. Some of us do it nicely. You know, we smile a lot and manipulate and get our own way. And some of us go rip-roaring through the universe like the tornado. And I was one of those. And so I knew that as long as I was in charge, it was going to be okay. So I arrived in Los Angeles on the 16th of July or 16th of August. And I was absolutely very hot because we had all these nunny clothes on. If you don't know about us, you might have looked at the bottle of blue nun wine. There's a picture of us there, or something like us. I just never thought that it counted because it had us on the outside of it, you know? Or at least something similar to what we wore, all black down to the floor, and then all this white stuff around our head. And oh, it was very hot, but I was going to be in charge. And so that was going to be okay, except that in a few days after I got there and settled in, this man came into my life, and he was known as the pastor. And he kind of thought that he was in charge. He did. I mean, he kept telling me that he was in charge, and I didn't know where the mix-up was. I knew that there was something went wrong there, and so he and I started to kill each other nicely. And it was really very uncomfortable, and I tried to not tell everybody else that I was feeling like this about him, but I was planning his demise mostly on a regular basis. And I was trying to get rid of him, write letters about him if I could, and anything that I could get him to go out of my life so that he wouldn't interfere with my position, which was in charge. Some of you sound like you know what I'm talking about here. That's good, because I wouldn't like to be up here talking to myself. It's wonderful when I hear the laughter. You know, laughter erases the errors in the brain. Did you know that? And laughter adds color to a world gone gray from inattention. And there's healing in laughter and in tears. And I think that happens to us when we come to meetings. You know, we get to be in touch with the humorous side of ourselves, and we get to not take ourselves too seriously, thanks be to God. And that's a gift. That's a real miracle. Anyway, I started into this fight with him, and I never got anywhere, really. And I got more and more and more uncomfortable until a magical thing happened for me, which most of you know the story, a lot of you know the story, that I was in my office one day after school, and a lady came to my door, and she said, would you have all the sisters come over and swim at our swimming pool? And we piled into the big, long station wagon. We went over there. We got into our swimsuits, and we swam. And she came out to the side of the pool with this big tray and a large, oh, I love large things, you know, large, large pitcher, and these lovely glasses with salt on the top. Oh, it was, you know, it was the most wonderful experience of my lifetime when I took this large draft of the beverage that was in the jug. Now, some of you know what was in the pitcher. In Sydney, Australia, they don't know that yet. And I'm wondering if you should be in these rooms until you've had a margarita. Now, I just think that margaritas were just the glue that held me together. They just sort of hit me in the back of the neck and went down to my shoulders and down my fingers. And I just knew that I was in the midst of the greatest spiritual awakening of my entire life. And I knew that I was going to have to get more of this in order to continue this spiritual path, you know? And so I asked the lady for the recipe to take home, and I thought that the nicest thing I could do for these nunny bunnies on a regular basis was to whip it up and give it to them and, you know, make them all feel good because they worked very hard because they worked for me. Now, I would say to them, some of you in this audience are teachers. You know, I used to say to them on Fridays, are you tired? And they'd say, oh, we're exhausted. And I'd say, well, let's celebrate this evening. Let's just, you know, kick back, is what they thought. But I meant, let's drink. You know, that's what I meant. And I noticed immediately with these gals that they didn't want to or like to drink like I did. I knew this from the very beginning because they would say things like, oh, well, let's have the little glasses. Ew, can you imagine that? You know, you understand, a lot of you here understand what I'm talking about. We were not interested in little. Large containers like flower pots are big. Plenty of it. And I don't know whether you ever enjoyed what you had in your hand. I never did because I was always thinking about when I was going to get the next one. How can I set this one up so that I can get more? That terrible, terrible tug of war going on within me all of the time. And so I would say things to them too, like, you know, on a Friday afternoon, I was principal of the school, and I would say to them, let's change all the classrooms. Let's move the first graders into the third grade. Let's move the second graders into the fourth grade. Let's move the second. Yeah, move everything. Chaotic, you know. And the more chaos there was, the better I thought that I was in charge. You know, or the more chaos there was, the less I needed to feel, or the more I felt there was being accomplished. And today, when I'm not working a good program, if I can introduce some chaos from somewhere or sabotage good stuff that's happening, you don't know what I'm talking about. I can tell by your faces. You know, if I can do that, then somehow I won't have to feel the feelings that I used to drink because I didn't want to feel them. You know, it's just incredible. So these gals were always exhausted with me around. And when they were my greatest enablers, they would say to me, oh, you look like you're exhausted. Why don't you have a little something to calm you down? They just would, anything, you know, just to keep our quiet, you know, here. And so, you know, they weren't too happy with me when I got into Alcoholics Anonymous because they didn't get me as quiet as they used to. And it was sort of hard for them. But anyway, what I started to do was I started to die. And one of the places that I drank mostly was Mexico. I knew that I wasn't supposed to drink on the job as a teacher or as a school principal. And so I would do a lot of reward drinking. Like I'm sure some of you know what that feels like. You know, if you haven't had one for a while, meaning like any time between 1 and 10 minutes or 3 hours or whatever, it's all relative to where you come from and what you do, then there's always the reward that you have to give yourself. So this fellow who lived close by, he had a trailer down in Mexico, and he came over one day to the convent, and he handed me the keys of this little trailer, and he said, you can use this anytime we're not there because we hardly ever get to go down anymore. So he showed me the three keys. I will never forget this. He said, this is the key of the front door. This is the key of the cabana. And this key, sister, is the key of the liquor cabinet. Help yourself. And I said, praise God from whom all blessings flow. And I meant it from the bottom of my heart because I knew that I had to get down there often. So I said to the nunny bunnies, now, very soon more than 50% of Southern California will be Hispanic. So we've got to get down to Mexico often so that we can learn how to speak Spanish. For those of you who are new, denial is built into this disease that we have, and we don't know that we're telling lies. We really don't know that we're telling lies at all. Even in recovery, we don't know that we're telling lies sometimes. We're very good at talking ourselves into situations And the way we do it is we usually blame them. It's always their fault. It's never hardly my fault. You know, it says somewhere admitting that we may be somewhat at fault. You know, just like once every 10 years maybe, but hardly ever. So I started this death, this internal death. And I tried for lots and lots of years to do what chapter 3 of the big book says we can't do. It says that we try very hard to do the impossible, which is to control and enjoy our drinking. And what I found that when I controlled my drink, have you ever tried that? When you control your drinking, you couldn't enjoy it. And when you enjoyed your drinking, you could not control it, you know? So it was a no-win situation all the way around. It was incredible. And it says in the book here, you know, that it drives us to the gates of insanity or death. And that we spend a lot of energy trying to do that. And I spent years trying to get that magic combination that I was, you know, that I was just going to be feeling okay, like, all the time. Now, I wasn't much into drugs. I hadn't met some of you yet, so you wouldn't have told me how I could get cocaine and stuff, you know, that I could. You probably, some of you would have bought it for me now, I know that. But I was into prescription drugs somewhat because the doctor had given me a prescription for Elavil and Stelzine. And then I had graduated into another couple called Valium and Librium. And I had all these prescriptions at the same time. And when I swilled them down with a little bit of vodka, I felt like the lights are on, but there's nobody home. You know, that kind of a look on my face. You know, I just was like the music on Twilight Zone, you know, way out there, not quite in touch. And so I kind of gave those up myself. I just didn't like what they did for me. Alcohol definitely was the drug of my choice. I graduated into other drinks like scotch and vodka and rum and anything, eventually anything that I could get so that it would just keep my feelings down so that I wouldn't have to feel, and I wouldn't have to especially feel the pain. And that's what most of us drank over, not wanting to feel the pain. Thanks be to God to have a way to go now that we have found through the steps that we can do it other. We do have to feel the pain, but we know that the pain will go away eventually if we stay close to our higher power and if we connect with one another. For years, I tried real hard to stop drinking just with God and myself, just the two of us, and I did lots of praying. I remember making a 30-day retreat up in Northern California. And on the 15th day, the priest told us that we didn't have to do all the retreat exercises, which was lots of praying and fasting and all of that stuff. And they said to me, is there any place special you would like to go to visit today? And I said, yes, I would like to go to see the Napa Valley, please. Because I thought it was kind of cultural if you did that. And I thought it was very fancy to be going in all the wineries, drinking those little godforsaken glasses of wine, you know, just so that I could quench my terrible thirst. And on the 30th day of that retreat, I remember all I wanted to do was to get back home to the southern part of California so that I could get drinking again. And so what I always tell people is that God and I, on our own, could never keep me sober. We never could do that. I had to meet you. I had to meet you so that I could connect with you and I could identify with you. And I could identify the same feelings as you have. And so that I had to be somebody that I was not unique. I had to be very, very regular, just to be a regular drunk. And it was very hard for me to do this because I have this other problem that they have in Ireland. Some of us have it. It's called arrogance. And that means that we know better than anybody how to do everything. So God forbid that we'd ever be, you know, anyone telling us how to do things. It's just incredible how we do that. And so I was in dreadful pain. I will never forget the pain. And my bottom was, you know, where I was in my convent. I often ask groups this size, you know, do you remember where you were when you knew you had to get help, when you died inside? Do you remember where you were? Do you remember, you know, were you in a hospital? Were you in an accident? Were you highly functional, like I was trying to be, juggling all of these plates up in the air, or saucers or something? Do you remember that moment? Now, Bill Wilson talks about it here on page 8 of the big book, and the way he describes it is this. He says, no words can tell of the loneliness and despair. Now, if there's anything that evens us all out, it doesn't matter where we came from, how old we are, what sort of an educational background we have, if we had a religion or if we didn't have a religion, the one thing that evens all of us out here is that we understand that. We understand the loneliness and the despair. And he talks about the bitter morass of self-pity when alcohol overcame him and became his master. And now he was totally overwhelmed. And he had finally met his match. And like many of you, I'm sure, in this room, there were lots of things that I could do. And the one thing I could not do without the help of a higher power and the help of people like you was to stay sober. I could not do that. And I tried everything possible, everything possible. And so I was standing in our living room in the convent. We call it the community room. And I happened to pick up a little pamphlet. And on the back page, there was an ad. And the ad said, "Sister, are you concerned about your drinking? If so, please call this number, collect." So I made a collect phone call to Massachusetts at 9 o'clock at night in California, midnight in Massachusetts. And I talked to this lady. And I told her some lies, which you've never done. I know, I can tell by looking at you. You've never told a lie in your lives. And I told her that I was very concerned about other people's drinking. You know, I didn't know how I was ever going to get them all into shape, all these imaginary people that I knew were drunks. And could she help me? And she told me, she told me lots of information about literature, about recovery hospitals and everything. And at the last moment, she just said to me, when I was just about to hang up the phone and thank her, she said, "Sister, would you like to tell me a little bit about your own drinking?" And I will never know how they're so smart in Massachusetts. They're brilliant people. People from back east are brilliant, Florence. They really are. Yeah. I mean, how she knew this, I just couldn't understand. And at that moment, by the grace of God, and I consider this to be totally and completely the grace of God, I broke down into the phone and I told her that I did not know who to tell, who to ask, where to get help, where to go, what I was going to do, because, and I totally impressed her how important I was and how indispensable I was and how terribly brilliant I was, and oh God, help me. And all the degrees I had, especially the degree on God, and all of that stuff. And she listened, and she was very nice. And she said, "You know, I can hear pain in your voice." And I think of all the gifts that we've been given in sobriety, one of the greatest gifts is that we can hear the pain in one another's voices, and we can see the pain in one another's eyes. And because we are given to understand that, then somehow we can help with the healing, with the ongoing healing. We can be God's instruments of healing. It's a very profound truth, this, and it's always amazing to me how it happens. So she told me that, you know, she heard this pain and she said, "With all the loving concern I have for another human being, I'm asking you to do something about your drinking." And so I hung up and I thought, well, I don't know what I'm going to do. I just don't know what I'm going to do. And so the next day I called a meeting, I looked in the telephone book for Alcoholics Anonymous, and I found an AA meeting away far from where I lived. I live in North Orange County, and I found a meeting in a place called Whittier. And it was a good long journey from where I live. And I was very important in those days, too, and I didn't want anybody to know who I was. Did any of you have that problem? Like, anonymity was terribly important to me. And so I took off all my nunny clothes that we used to wear in those days, and I put on regular clothes, and I put on some cheap eye makeup, and I went down to this place in Whittier. It was called Serenity Hall. And it was a tiny little room about the size of this area just up here, and it was filled with smoke and little old men. That's what I thought. Now, that doesn't mean it's true, but that's what I thought. And these little old men seemed to be just shuffling all over Serenity Hall. And they were the wise kind. Now, I don't know, you probably don't have them up here. We have them a lot in California. You know, who would say such things as, "Oh, honey, I spilt more than you ever drank." You know, that type. And they were really, you know, smart. And then there were two women there, but one left and one stayed. And the one who stayed was She was a little off the beam. In Ireland, she was not the full shilling. You know, she was just not all there. Or she was one taco short of a combination plate, they told me another place. Or two sandwiches short of a picnic, you know what I mean? She was crazy. She was laughing out loud and clapping at the wrong time. And, oh, she was just off. And I'm thinking, oh, dear Lord, what am I going to do here? Well, that part was fair and okay. And then this fellow, there was a podium that they came up to talk at, and they were sharing their experience, strength and hope at this podium. And this fellow got up to share his. And he told us he was sober for a while now, and he had his family back, and he had his job back, and he was doing very well. But what was really fascinating to me about him was that he was, he had tremendous feebleness of vocabulary, let us say. He was using words that I used to punish the eighth graders for writing on the bathroom walls. Like, he was using a word regularly that starts with sh. And then he moved into another one that starts with f. Don't listen to this, Florence. This is bad. This is the bad part. And he went on. You know, he used the f word as a noun, a verb, an adjective, an adverb, and a preposition, and a conjunction. All the time, you know. And he used it in sentences. He used it with ing on the end and with ed on the end. It's true. And on one occasion, he used the f word with the word mother before it. And I can remember thinking, and this is going to be my spiritual leader for the rest of my life. I was very upset, you know. And then at the end of the whole meeting, they said, keep coming back, it works. You know, I couldn't understand this. Well, I got into the car to go home after this dreadful meeting. Nothing. I mean, I just didn't know how I was ever going to stick around. And I got into the car to go home, and I was crying hard, and it was raining outside, and this stuff I put in my eyes was rolling down my face. And I looked in the mirror and I saw this, and I said the sh word and the f word all the way home to the convent. Now, I'm not advocating that we do that. However, I'm telling you that I had so much anger and frustration and rage at having to do this in my life. And you know, I was thinking as I walked into this room this evening, I could have missed this. I could have missed this whole deal. You know, I mean, can you imagine what my life would be like if I didn't have you? I don't know what I would do if I didn't have you. I just don't know what I would ever do. But I have to tell you, especially I have to tell the newcomers, that I wasn't one of these people who walked into Alcoholics Anonymous and knew that I was home. You know how, you know how some of them do that? You know, they kind of get it from the word go. I sponsor people who kind of do that. You know, they just do everything I tell them, really. And you know, I couldn't do that for the longest time. Now, I want to talk to you people who find it hard to surrender. I come from the north of Ireland, and so on the graffiti that we write in our walls is no surrender. And you come into this deal called Alcoholics Anonymous, and they tell you that the only way you're going to ever get anywhere is to surrender. And you think, how can you do that? I mean, it's in my blood. It's in all my Celtic blood tells me I'm never to give up, I'm to fight to the death, and then I'm to win. Now, how do you do that if you're Irish or Norwegian or Mexican or African or whatever, you know? We all have this terrible thing in us that we're supposed to fight to the death. And they tell you that you have to give up to win. And then you say, well, how do you do that? And they say, you hang in there, you know. And you think, God, this is such a weird thing. It's all so contradictory, you know, the whole deal. Anyway, at these meetings that I was going to, they were basically suggesting five things. They were saying, don't drink. Now, it was just before Christmas, December. Now, how do you think a nunny bunny who hardly ever got to drink much, you know, except at Christmas time was one of the legal times to drink? How do you think I could do Christmas without drinking? And these people were suggesting don't drink or use any mind-altering drugs. And that was going to be really hard. And I remember telling a woman in the meeting that I didn't think I was going to be able to do that because I was hosting a Christmas party for all the other school principals in the area. And they would all notice if I didn't drink. We're so important, you know. Somebody said to me one time, "Be count yourself, you're not so many." You know, it's a terrible insult. This is a real insult to us. You know, we're so responsible for the entire human race. I'm responsible for everybody on the airplane and at the airports and on the news and everything. Do you know what I mean? We're very into it. That's the brand of selfishness that it talks about on page 62 of the big book here. You know, there's 100 forms of them, but that brand of being totally responsible for everything, you know. So then they were saying, don't drink. And then they said, go to meetings. And I would honor them and with my presence on an irregular basis. I hated the meetings. And I hated the smoke. And I hated the, keep coming back. And rarely have we seen a person fail. And all that stuff. And I think, gosh, they must think we're awfully low in intelligence here, you know. And then they said, read the book. Now, I took the book down to the beach one day to read it. And to my dismay, I found out that it was not the most well-written book in the English language, that it requires quite a bit of punctuation and the sentences to be reconstructed and all of that. And so I took the liberty of correcting the book. And I put in like little commas and sentences and parentheses and fixed it all up so that the clauses would flow. And I told them this in Serenity Hall. And they said, keep coming back, B. Just keep coming back. They were very kind to me. I don't know how they ever stood me. And then they said something about sponsor. That would be a good thing to get a sponsor. Now, being Irish and very reticent and private and all, and I didn't think there was anybody here that could help me because I was so superior to everybody. You understand? You know, I mean, God, had all these information, especially God information. I knew all this God stuff, and it was, and they were telling me I had to get people to teach me the steps. Imagine. And so what I did was I interviewed some women and I hired them on temporarily. You know, I didn't get too serious about any of this. And then I let them go when they weren't saying things that I thought they should be saying to me. And they weren't giving me the due honor and respect that I knew was coming to me. And then they were suggesting also that I would work the steps. And the steps, you know, again, there was nothing in the steps that I didn't hear before somewhere along the line, and certainly I didn't think there was anything there that would enhance what I already had. And these pieces of paper in my bottom drawer that are degrees on various things, especially my ones on God, and I certainly didn't think that there was anything there that I could learn any more about. And so I was terribly, terribly unwilling. Now, I didn't drink, and the only reason I didn't drink was because I knew they knew, they would know, especially the women. The women would ask you very curious questions. They were, as we say in Sydney, sticky beaks. You know, they'd stick their nose into your business. They'd ask you sticky beaks. You know, they'd, where do you live, Bea? And I'd say, this is an anonymous program. I wouldn't tell them anything. They were hard, you know, I just didn't like them intruding in my life. They just didn't know how important I was and didn't have any place any value on the fact that they had me in their presence, and it was just awful. And so I was miserable in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, you don't have to do it like this, and I hope that those of you who are new won't. I hope you won't do it like this, because I was very, very, very upset in the program for a long, long time, and I was miserable. And I was going to AA meetings, and I was crying at nearly every single meeting I would go into. Not from the kind of crying I do today, which is gratitude, mostly. Or crying for somebody else's pain. Sometimes I do that. But the crying I did then was crying with frustration and rage and anger because I didn't want to be there. And I just knew that this was not the place for me to be. Now, one day I went into Serenity Hall in Whittier. And again, I was crying. I was sort of sniveling to myself. And I was just like, oh, no, I wouldn't let anyone come near me. I wouldn't let anyone touch me or hug me. I hated that. And now I hug everybody. And this older member of the program who has since passed away, he said, you're always miserable. And this program is really, you know, supposed to help you to be happy, joyous, and free. That's what Michael has in his license on the back of his car. You know, happy, joyous, and free. And I missed that part for the longest time. And he said, he just sat me down and I told him everything that I could think of that was wrong with Alcoholics Anonymous. And I figured that he was like an elder or something. He was kind of half in charge. And that maybe there would be some way that he could take my advice and change some of the stuff in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he was listening very intently and I knew that he was gleaning a lot from what I had to say. And he was nodding his head and he was really gentle and he was very, very patient. And then he said, you know, Bea, I can tell you something that might change everything for you. And I said, what's that? And he said, why don't you just try this one thing? Why don't you go home and kneel down and ask God to give you the willingness to change your attitude? Now, with all the information that I had on God, nobody had ever, I'd never heard anyone say that to me. Never heard that before. And so I did that one little thing. I just did that one thing. And I'd love to tell you that God appeared to me, and there was a burning bush and all the rest of it. But I just know this much, that I know two things about praying for willingness, and that is that God is always delighted. I always imagine God saying to me, B, I thought you'd never ask. I'm just thrilled to give you enough willingness for today. You're just for Saturday. Now, why God can't go into my calendar, which is 1998 and 1999, and figure all that stuff out and you know, let me know everything about it and all, I don't know why that is, but God just does Saturdays on Saturday. Isn't that weird? But God, the other thing about that is that God never says no. And when I get stuck, now I know this doesn't happen to you. You look so clean and so willing from here. You really do. But that's the truth. But if you ever get stuck in your continued recovery, you know, that's when you get to these plateaus of, nothing changes if nothing changes. You know, that's part where you can't move or you get paralyzed a little bit inside or you just don't want to do one more surrender. Ever get there in between surrenders where there's just another one you have to do? I hear some giggling going on, so I'm assuming that there might be a few people who have been in between surrenders. Now, the recipe for being in between surrenders in recovery, in continued sobriety, is to pray for the willingness. And immediately, God will remove that obstacle and you'll be able to do it. Now, how that happens, don't ask me because I don't know. I only know that it works. Every time I get stuck. You know, it's easy for us to get stuck because the old stuff comes back in again, the old toxins of fear and resentment, they move in again easily into our, if we're not constantly vigilant. And the book tells us we can't rest on our laurels. And if we do, we are headed for trouble. That's what it tells us, you know. It's really, you know, we've sort of been on our toes the whole time and just watching out, you know, watching out for the stuff. Well, anyway, I was delighted when finally I was driving down the 57 freeway in deep traffic about 4 days after I prayed for the willingness, and I looked in the mirror and I saw the sunset for the very first time in Southern California. And it occurred to me that I hadn't thought of a drink for several days. And I knew at that moment, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that the merciless obsession, like the 12 and 12 tells us, had been removed from me. I knew that. And I got really excited about the fact that I was in this deal and that I hadn't had a drink for a while, even though I didn't want to work the program. And then I got very excited about the program. And I started to understand what it says on page 62. And this is what it says to me. And it always says it to me because if I read it like it's to them, I won't pay attention. So what I say is, B, this is the book says this to me, B, this is the how and the why of it. You have to quit playing God because it doesn't work. Imagine. Now, I never thought I was God, but I was positive that I was Mrs. God and that I was in charge, you know, that I would write lists for God and tell God what to do. And if God did it, it was fine. But if God didn't do it, I was upset. And this, you know, you have to quit playing God because it doesn't work, or Mrs. God. And hereafter, in this drama of life, God's going to be your director. And he's the principal, and you're his agent, and he's the father, and you're his child. And then it says, most good ideas are simple. Oh, so simple. They're so simple that, you know, I missed it. I almost missed the whole deal. But this concept that God's in charge is the keystone of the new and triumphant arch through which you're going to pass to freedom. And all I ever wanted was that inner freedom. And I was just getting into the understanding of that 9 years ago, Ron, when you invited me up here to speak at that roundup you had, when you had freedom and sobriety. And you had right across the top are these extravagant promises. And I'd been praying and asking God to show me if I was supposed to get into this sort of stuff and maybe do a retreat on the promises or on different aspects of recovery. And the minute that I saw that whole sign up there, you know, of course, I took it home with me. I still have it at home. I take everything, you know, I take it all and take it all home. I knew, you see, that's why you people are so important to me, because I started into a whole new life as a result of getting involved with this, with the promises of the program. And I discovered, and I won't go through this with you because many of you know this, but that there are 13 promises in step 3. On page 63, there are 13 promises. There are 13 references to self and self-centeredness on page 62, and then 13 promises on 63. Isn't that wonderful? It's a sign, as I always say, it's a sign. And then there are 6 promises in step 4, and the one I love the most in step 4 is the one that when God removes our fear, the fear prayer on page 68, which I've done with many of you at the retreats, God, remove my fear and direct my attention to what you would have me be. And the promise then says, at once, don't you love this? At once we commence to outgrow fear. Isn't that a wonderful promise? It doesn't say maybe next week or next year, or if you continue doing this, it says now, right away. Muy pronto. You commence to outgrow fear. I love that. I love when they hurry up in the program because it's awfully slow. For the newcomers, it's a very slow program. And we have to really be on our toes a lot of the time. I think there are 10 promises in step 5, and one of them is we can look the world in the eye. Imagine people like us who are so embarrassed and so ashamed and so, you know, just so in the fetal position, you know, almost, because we were so afraid. And now we can stand tall and look the world in the eye. What a gift. I found the God of my understanding when I took step 7, which I've often shared, step 6 and 7. And when I found step 7, and I said the prayer on page 76 here of the big book, it says, my Creator, I am now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. And immediately I knew that that was the God who would take me just the way I was, that I didn't have to be perfect for God anymore. I didn't have to prove. I didn't have to impress. It was just wonderful. Just wonderful. And then I understood what I had taught everybody else, that God loved them so much that he would carve their name on the palm of his hand, or that he would store up their tears and put them into a little bottle, or he would dance with shouts of joy over them. But I just never thought that God would do that for me, because I felt so little and so inadequate and so holly hobby, you know, just so little holly hobby, you know, just with the freckles and red hair and just didn't fit anywhere until I found this step 7. And then I knew that my head and my heart matched. I got this intuitive understanding of God through taking step 7. And I always call it the self-esteem prayer, because most of us, when we get here, we don't have too much of that. And it's hard to keep it, too. It's hard to keep our self-esteem. And so we have to continue doing things that will help us to feel good about our own insides, and then our outsides and our insides start matching. What a miracle that gets to be. I got to understand what the promises that were read this evening by Joseph, you know, that they're not extravagant promises, but they are being fulfilled sometimes quickly and sometimes slowly. But all of them, every single one of those on page 83 and 84 have come true for me. I have experienced every single one of them. I think the one that I love the most is, we will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. And I believe that you know, my life is full of suddenlies. Do you know that? I was sharing, I think it was with Michael on the way out here, and I was sharing with Josephine just before the meeting, One of the suddenlies that I got today as I was driving to the airport was, and this may sound like nothing to you at all, but for me this is a sudden, big sudden revelation. I'm thinking to myself as I'm going to the airport, thanks be to God, I'm leaving home today and I'm speaking to everybody and everybody loves me and they're anxious about when I'll be coming back tomorrow and they're happy with me and I'm not causing conflict. Now, that doesn't mean to say that I wouldn't be capable of doing it at noon tomorrow when I get there. You know what I mean? But what I'm saying is for right now, that there's a general feeling of peace, you know, just a general feeling of peace around me. And of course, many of you here know that I live now in the 11th step house that you'll all have to come and see. And many of you have encouraged me and helped me to get there and to that place, St. Clair's Garden. And I look out the window at the miracles that have happened there. And I just know that I'm suddenly realizing that God did for me what I could not do for myself. I'm very impressed with the promises of step 10. There are about 8 of them in step 10. The first one for a woman from the north of Ireland is, we cease fighting. Can you believe that? We cease fighting, everything and everybody, even alcohol. And it promises us in step 10 that we will be placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. And that we'll be able to develop a vital sixth sense, that we not only have it inside of us, this intuition, but we will be developing it. It's incredible, the promises there on on step 10. And of course, the promises in step 11 are phenomenal also. You know, what used to be the hunch, listen to this for a promise, what used to be the hunch or the occasional inspiration gradually becomes a working part of the mind. I can now start trusting my intuition. What a gift. You know, that means we know what we know what we know inside of us. And we develop that. We develop that gift through prayer and meditation. And it's real clear in the big book. It's so clear. Page 86 tells us exactly what we're supposed to do when we wake up in the morning. Now, you all wake up nice. I can tell by looking at you. But I wake up and Grand Central Station has already moved in to the bottom of the bed, you know, and their committee is going and they're telling me about all the people I should be getting after today, at least 10 people that I should get back at for something they did 3 or 4 years ago, you know what I mean? And I rehearse for retaliation, you know, I practice, I'm going to say this and they're going to say that and then I'm going to write this and yeah. And the book says we ask God to direct our thinking, you know, God, please settle me down. Please do something about this thought process I have, because I get really out of whack here. I lose my perspective. It even gives recipes for when you get agitated. It's wonderful, isn't it? Everything's there for us in this deal. And there are 25 promises in step 12. 25. They're fabulous promises about not being so lonely, and we get to understand what it's like to be helping other people and the joy of that and the joy of being of service. It's just such a fantastic way to live. I don't know how this thing works. I often say that. I just know that it does, and I know that you have committees here that get this sort of a deal going regularly, at least a couple of times a year, and you have your meetings. But the 12th step works through us all showing up to do whatever it is we're asked to do. God works in the most mysterious ways and through the most mysterious people. And we never quite understand how it's going to happen or when. And when we least expect it, kind of like candid camera, God moves in and goes, peek-a-boo, you know, here I am. And we get to know then that this is the message we were supposed to hear. And it may not have been our chosen messenger. Isn't that interesting? That's the mystery of it. And we have to believe that. That's why the big book tells us that love and tolerance of others is our code. So we have to stay out of judging other people. Very hard to do that. But it's very important that we do, because in this deal, what we do, we speak the language of the heart, which is the language of love. And it's the language of understanding and the language of knowing what pain other people are in. And we never know. I heard somebody say recently, if we knew all, we would forgive all. If we knew everything about everybody, what they've been through, and everything, all about the circumstances, all about their lives, we would forgive everything. And sometimes we don't know the whole story. I want to tell you how grateful I am to be here. I want to thank those of you who have come a long distance to be here tonight. to be with me. I'm real grateful, very touched by that. And I want to tell you that there are some really sick people in this room, because some of them are going to come to Spokane next weekend to a retreat that I'm giving there. So some are sicker than others. There's one down there. Oh, God. And he's going to pretend that he never heard any of this before, you know. He's just going to act like it's all new. And it will be all new, because I'll be all new by next week. I'm just very impressed. And I want to thank you, Joseph, for inviting me. I think it was over a year ago when you asked me to do this. And I've kept it 2 years ago, my gosh. And I've kept it solidly on my calendar. And Laurie, I want to thank you so much for getting this going. And it's just been a wonderful experience. And Mike and Barbara, I want to thank you for picking me up at the airport. But most of all, I want to thank Ron and Ray Angus, because they have, well, especially Ron has, Ron and Ray were prayed together by one of our nunny bunnies. We prayed for them until he finally could pop the question. It took him a while. And but we've been friends for a long time, and Ron was my first connection with this place, and I'm always delighted to see you again, and I'm so happy to have you in my life, Ray, and to have you, Rex. And may God bless you, and I love you from the bottom of my heart. Thank you.